Now, News Talk Radio CJAD 800 presents the CEO Series, insights from top business leaders. Your host is Carl Moore.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. The CEO Series takes you inside our capstone MBA class at McGill. Each week, we sit down with some of Canada and indeed the world's top leaders to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Mohamed Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Eileen Murray, co-CEO of Bridgewater, one of the world's largest hedge funds. The show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin, slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders our McGill MBAs are exposed to. Today, I'm delighted to speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and the International Air Transport Association, which is headquartered in Geneva and here in Montreal as well. Today, Tony sits on the boards of Qantas, Bombardier, BOC Aviation, and the Trans-Moldavian Airways. He also is a fellow of the Royal Aeronautics Society. Thank you for joining us today, Tony.
My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about your early years. Where did you grow up and what did your family do for a living?
Well, I was born in Egypt, but I didn't stay there very long. And when I was still a baby, basically went back to the UK where my family came from. And I was brought up there and in Malta, where my father was posted for 5 years when I was 8 years old. So and then back in the UK. I came from a military family. Basically, my father was a senior army officer, and both my brothers also went into the army and became very senior army officers as well. They all made the rank of major general, so it was quite cool having three major generals in the family. And most of my brothers-in-law were military people too, so it was a very military background.
If you had three ended up as major generals and yourself as a CEO, it seems like in the family there's kind of a natural leadership gene or something.
I don't know. I think, because in my family, things like, discipline and resilience and loyalty and respect were all very highly valued in the family. And I think without it ever being expressed, there were always quite high expectations. It was just expected to work hard and to do well. But it was never really, never very overt.
So were you always interested in aviation, or did that come after you went to uni?
As a little boy, I wanted to fly fast jets in the Royal Air Force. But then living abroad, as we did in Malta, and flying back and forth to school in England as a young schoolboy, obviously, became very interested. I mean, it's an exciting thing, isn't it? And, in those days, we were flying on what was then British European Airways. I remember flying Vanguards and Comets and Tridents. Sometimes we went on the Malta Airlines Viscount. So I was always very interested in what we were flying on and the whole operation and just excitement of it all. So although I never thought at that point I was going to have a career in the airline business, it's something that doesn't surprise me looking back.
So where did you go to university and what did you study?
Well, my best subject at school was physics, but I didn't want to be an engineer or a scientist. And so after looking at it and taking some advice, I read law at university, at Oxford University, where in fact they call it jurisprudence. And I have no regrets at all about doing that. I did intend when I started to become a lawyer, but changed my mind halfway through my university career. But I think it was still a very useful thing to have studied and very useful thing for me to have sort of, if you like, moved away from the sciences into something a bit more general.
What did law teach you that's still useful today, if anything?
I think what it teaches is a very useful discipline in rational thinking, in to be able to analyze, to be able to distinguish between similarities and differences in particular situations, to be able to forecast and think ahead about the consequences. A legal training and legal experience of some kind is very helpful in developing those things, which are very useful in managing and leading organizations.
What was your first job at a university, and what did you learn from it?
I had, of course, many part-time jobs while I was still at school and in university, things from working on building sites to selling ballpoint pens in South Africa. And of course, I think I learned quite a lot from those kind of experiences too. But my first proper job, if you like, was with the Swire Group, whom I joined on leaving university. And that was a trainee position, basically, in a refrigerated road transport and cold storage company in Australia. And it was good fun, but it was also quite interesting because being a quite relatively small company, you did see a lot of different aspects of operations and management. One lesson I did learn, and it's a bit of a long story, so I won't go into it, but I did learn to beware the distortions you can get if you have too much transfer pricing going on within a company.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and IATA. So you come up, there's this tall Brit with an Oxford accent, and you're dealing with a bunch of Australian truck drivers. It just strikes me as a formula for a bit of trouble.
Yeah, and then when I won the office sweepstake on the Melbourne Cup too in my first month there, it didn't help either. But look, it was good fun, and I've always been one to get on and enjoy myself and muck in with whatever's going on locally. And I certainly took a bit of stick for the Oxford accent, but then if you can't take that, you're never gonna succeed. And it was really good fun, and I love Australia, and I've always got on very well with Australians and enjoy their company. So it was a great experience.
That was a long way from home in the sense that I guess home was the UK. You might argue Malta a bit, but why did you choose to go so far away?
Well, I really chose, of course, to come and base myself in Hong Kong because that's where the Swire Group has most of its operations. So the Australian experience was one that there was a little bit of an outlier for that. But I tell you why. I was at university in the UK in the mid-1970s, from 74 to 77. And they were terrible years for the UK. I mean, the 1970s were dreadful in the UK. The country was riven with social problems, the dominance of the unions in how the country was governed was leading to all sorts of problems, which the government didn't seem to have any will to deal with. We went from a pretty useless Conservative government to a pretty useless Labour government. It was just miserable. I just wanted to get out, to be honest. I mean, and because, my family had, all members of my family had sort of lived around the world and had at least part of their careers overseas, it wasn't a big deal for me to think about living and working overseas. And so really, when I was coming to leave university and applying for jobs, I just applied for jobs that would get me out of the UK. And Swire has offered me a job which would take me to Hong Kong, give me a career that would work in other places in Asia Pacific, probably. And at that time, wasn't much prospect of working anywhere else in Europe or whatever, although that changed later. And they promised, never to bring me back. To me, that was just, as a sort of 21, 22-year-old, that sounded ideal. So off I went.
Clearly, you're a leader today, and you've been a leader in your career. When did you first see yourself as a leader? Was it in elementary, high school, after uni? When did you say, I might be a leader?
At school, I captained a rugby team, and I became was appointed the head boy of the school. So I guess people must have seen some leadership potential in me at that point. And looking back, most of the rugby teams I played for, or many of them anyway, if I played for any length of time, I ended up captaining them. So I suppose, I must have had something going there. My first real sort of leadership job was when I was, 29 years old, and I was appointed by Cathay Pacific Airways to be their manager in West Japan, which at the time was a hugely important region for the company in terms of revenue generation and operations. So I suppose that was my first serious management leadership role.
We're speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific and IATA. Coming up, we'll discuss the incredible impact of COVID-19 on the aviation industry. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series.
You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. The CEO Series takes you inside our capstone MBA class at McGill. Each week, we sit down with some of Canada, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Mohamed Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Eileen Murray, co-CEO of Bridgewater, one of the world's largest hedge funds. The show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin, slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders our McGill MBAs are exposed to. Today, I'm delighted to speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and the International Air Transport Association, which is headquartered in Geneva and here in Montreal as well. Today, Tony sits on the boards of Qantas, Bombardier, BOC Aviation, and the Trans-Moldavian Airways. He also is a fellow of the Royal Aeronautics Society. Thank you for joining us today, Tony.
My pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about your early years. Where did you grow up and what did your family do for a living?
Well, I was born in Egypt, but I didn't stay there very long. And when I was still a baby, basically went back to the UK where my family came from. And I was brought up there and in Malta, where my father was posted for 5 years when I was 8 years old. So and then back in the UK. I came from a military family. Basically, my father was a senior army officer, and both my brothers went into the army and became very senior army officers as well. They all made the rank of major general, so it was quite cool having three major generals in the family. And my brothers-in-law were military people too, so it was a very military background.
If you had three ended up as major generals and yourself as a CEO, it seems like in the family there's kind of a natural leadership gene or something.
I don't know. I think, because in my family, things like, discipline and resilience and loyalty and respect were all very highly valued in the family. And I think without it ever being expressed, there were always quite high expectations. Just expected to work hard and to do well. But it was never really, never very overt.
So were you always interested in aviation, or did that come after you went to uni?
As a little boy, I wanted to fly fast jets in the Royal Air Force. But then living abroad, as we did in Malta, and flying back and forth to school in England as a young schoolboy, obviously, became very interested. I mean, it's an exciting thing, isn't it? And, in those days, we were flying on what was then British European Airways. I remember flying Vanguards and Comets and Tridents. Sometimes we went on the Malta Airlines Viscount. So I was always very interested in what we were flying on and the whole operation and just excitement of it all. So although I never thought at that point I was going to have a career in the airline business, it's something that doesn't surprise me looking back.
So where did you go to university and what did you study?
Well, my best subject at school was physics, but I didn't want to be an engineer or a scientist. And so after looking at it and taking some advice, I read law at university, at Oxford University, where in fact they call it jurisprudence. And I have no regrets at all about doing that. I did intend when I started to become a lawyer, but changed my mind halfway through my university career. But I think it was still a very useful thing to have studied and very useful thing for me to have sort of, if you like, moved away from the sciences into something a bit more general.
What did law teach you that's still useful today, if anything?
I think what it teaches is a very useful discipline in rational thinking, in to be able to analyze, to be able to distinguish between similarities and differences in particular situations, to be able to forecast and think ahead about the consequences. A legal training and legal experience of some kind is very helpful in developing those things, which are very useful in managing and leading organizations.
What was your first job at a university, and what did you learn from it?
I had, of course, many part-time jobs while I was still at school and in university, things from working on building sites to selling ballpoint pens in South Africa. And of course, I think I learned quite a lot from those kind of experiences too. But my first proper job, if you like, was with the Swire Group, whom I joined on leaving university. And that was a trainee position, basically, in a refrigerated road transport and cold storage company in Australia. And it was good fun, but it was also quite interesting because being a quite relatively small company, You did see a lot of different aspects of operations and management. One lesson I did learn, and it's a bit of a long story, so I won't go into it, but I did learn to beware the distortions you can get if you have too much transfer pricing going on within a company.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and IATA. So you come up, there's this tall Brit with an Oxford accent, and you're dealing with a bunch of Australian truck drivers. It just strikes me as a formula for a bit of trouble.
Yeah, and then when I won the office sweepstake on the Melbourne Cup too in my first month there, it didn't help either. But look, it was, I think, it was good fun, and I've always been one to get on and enjoy myself and muck in with whatever's going on locally. And I certainly took a bit of stick for the Oxford accent, but then if you can't take that, you're never going to succeed. And it was really good fun, and I love Australia, and I've always got on very well with Australians and enjoy their company. So it was a great experience.
That was a long way from home in the sense that I guess home was the UK. You might argue Malta a bit, but why did you choose to go so far away?
Well, I really chose, of course, to come and base myself in Hong Kong because that's where the Swire Group has most of its operations. So the Australian experience was one that there was a little bit of an outlier for that. But I tell you why. I was at university in the UK in the mid-1970s, from 74 to 77. And they were terrible years for the UK. I mean, the 1970s were dreadful in the UK. The country was riven with social problems, the dominance of the unions in how the country was governed was leading to all sorts of problems, which the government didn't seem to have any will to deal with. We went from a pretty useless Conservative government to a pretty useless Labour government. It was just miserable. I just wanted to get out, to be honest. I mean, and because my family had, all members of my family had sort of lived around the world and had at least part of their careers overseas, it wasn't a big deal for me to think about living and working overseas. And so really, when I was coming to leave university and applying for jobs, I just applied for jobs that would get me out of the UK. And Swire has offered me a job which would take me to Hong Kong, give me a career that would work in other places in Asia Pacific, probably. And at that time, wasn't much prospect of working anywhere else in Europe or whatever, although that changed later. And they promised, never to bring me back. To me, that was just, as a sort of 21, 22-year-old, that sounded ideal. So off I went.
Clearly, you're a leader today, and you've been a leader in your career. When did you first see yourself as a leader? Was it in elementary, high school, after uni? When did you say, I might be a leader?
At school, I captained a rugby team and became was appointed the head boy of the school. So I guess, people must have seen some leadership potential in me at that point. And looking back, most of the rugby teams I played for, or many of them anyway, if I played for any length of time, I ended up captaining them. So I suppose, I must have had something going there. My first real sort of leadership job was when I was, 29 years old, and I was appointed by Cathay Pacific Airways to be their manager in West Japan, which at the time was a hugely important region for the company in terms of revenue generation and operations. So I suppose that was my first serious management leadership role.
We're speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific and IATA. Coming up, we'll discuss the incredible impact of COVID-19 on the aviation industry. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series.
This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and IATA. He currently sits on the boards of Qantas, Bombardier, BOC Aviation, and Trans-Moldavian Airways. How do they make money if they socially distance on a plane, that they only don't use the middle seats? It just seems like you need load levels in the 70s and 80s to begin to make money. And if you're down at the 60s and less, it seems like it's almost impossible to make money in a way that would keep you viable as an airline.
You're absolutely right. It would be impossible. Michael O'Leary, who is the boss of Ryanair, has been very forthright on this subject. And though I don't always agree with him on everything, I think he's absolutely right on this. Proper social distancing anyway requires a kind of 2 meter distance between people. So leaving an empty seat isn't going to help. And anyway, the important point is that the environment on an aeroplane is in fact a very safe environment from the point of view of spread of infection. The industry has been doing a lot of research on this, a lot of study of this subject. It's hard to find any cases where transmission of COVID-19 has taken place in an aeroplane. And the reasons for that are several. And it's the reason that we think for that is, first of all, the air on an aeroplane is only very partially recycled. Most of it is fresh. And the entire contents of the aeroplane's air are replaced every 2 or 3 minutes. The air that is recycled is passed through filters like they use in operating theatres of hospitals. HEPA filters, they're called, high-efficiency particulate arrestor filters. And the direction of flow of the aircraft is from the ceiling laterally down and out by the floor, so that people's droplets and breath is naturally pushed down and out of the cabin, rather than floating around the cabin. Also, people are sitting, not facing each other, and so on and so forth. So these are the reasons why it is thought that transmission on an aeroplane is extremely unusual. What's happening in the industry is airlines that are operating and are going back into the air are encouraging their passengers to wear masks. In some cases, they're being made mandatory, not in all. Masks are a very divisive subject. I'm a convert. Living in Hong Kong kind of makes you realize just how valuable they can be in the management of a thing like COVID-19. But many people don't agree. But people are on a flight. What's happening is that where people are spread out around an aircraft, people tend not to wear masks. Or where that is not happening, passengers tend to wear masks. But you're absolutely right, Carl. There's no way airlines can operate economically if they're forced to leave seats empty.
Are you up back to flying now? Are you willing to get on a plane and take the risk, if you would, of flying long haul out of Hong Kong?
I'm longing to get back on a plane. You know, much as I love Hong Kong, and I've had a great time over the last 3 months here, we haven't had lockdown or anything like that. I can't wait to get traveling again, and I'm not concerned about the risk. I'll take sensible precautions. I know the airlines will, and the airports and so on will also be implementing measures which will reduce the risk. I will be more concerned about visiting certain countries where they frankly don't have the virus under good control. I'm more concerned about the risk when I get there. I'll not be concerned about the risks of traveling.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and IATA. Tony, big airlines like Qantas have an advantage over small ones like Trans-Moldavian Airlines. Where is Trans-Moldavian Airlines located, and how are they faring?
Yeah, Trans-Moldavian is located in the Maldives, which is a country made up of a string of beautiful islands in the Indian Ocean. And Trans-Moldavian Airways is the largest operator of twin otter seaplanes in the world. They have a fleet of some 55 also seaplanes, which are based at Male, the capital. And they basically fly visitors to and from the island resorts in the Maldives. Their business has stopped completely because there are currently no international flights in and out of Male, the capital city, or any other city in the Maldives. And so the business has stopped completely. And it's a very difficult situation for them, as you can imagine. Qantas is, of course, in a very difficult position as well. But their situation is very different. They're very different types of businesses. The challenge actually for the airline in the Maldives is how do you preserve a fleet of 55 twin otter seaplanes in an environment which is hot, humid, and salty? Corrosion is always an issue when the airline's operating well, but when you really have a lot of planes sitting idle, it becomes a very important issue to manage, and that's what they're having to cope with at the moment, as well as financial challenges.
I guess that's why a bunch of the planes are sitting in California in the desert and so on. Just it's a better place to have them sit if they're going to sit.
If you're going to park airplanes, yeah, taking them to a dry environment is absolutely the best thing to do.
How about lessors like BOC Aviation? How's the impact on their business?
It's interesting because, first of all, of course, many of BOC Aviation's customers have come to them and asked for basically rent relief on the aircraft that they're leasing. And so the company's working through all those requests now and reaching agreement with a lot of customers on how they can help and trying to find appropriate ways to help them through the crisis that the airlines are having. But there are also opportunities for BOC Aviation to build its balance sheet by doing deals with carriers who in better times don't need them. In good times, airlines need the aircraft that the lessors have. But of course, the big carriers have their own sources of finance and they have their own big order streams with the manufacturers. So the lessors, although they play a role, aren't so critical. But in bad times, the liquidity that a company like BOC Aviation can offer is very valuable to even the big, strong airlines. And BOC Aviation has written about $5.5 billion worth of business with very good big, strong carriers like American, United, Southwest, Cathay Pacific, Wizz Air in Europe.
Take out your crystal ball, Tony, and when do you think we'll be back somewhat close to where we were in January? Is it going to be 2 years, 5 years? What's your sense of how long it's going to take for the airline industry to get back? And what are the key things the world needs for it to get back even close to where it was just January?
I think domestic aviation will be back within a couple of years. We should see domestic aviation getting close to levels that it was last year. The reason that it won't be happening faster than that is that quite a bit of domestic aviation is related to international. And international is going to take a lot longer. First of all, borders have to be open. Passengers have got to feel safe actually flying. As I said earlier, I think they should, but it's going to take quite an effort to get some people across that line. And then they've got to feel safe about where they're going. I wonder whether people will be as happy post-COVID-19 as they were pre-COVID-19 to fly halfway around the world to a country where they don't speak the language. They have no idea what the public health system is like. And they're going to be thinking to themselves, hey, wait a minute, what if I get ill? What if I catch COVID-19? Or what if I get something else? And I end up in their public health system. What is it going to be like? And very importantly, can I get insurance for it? And at the moment, it's looking like it's going to be very difficult to get COVID-19 travel insurance. And that is going to be, a serious drag on the demand for international travel. So I think I can't put a number of years on it, but I think it's going to be more than 2 years before we see international travel back where it was.
We're speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific and IATA. Up next, we'll talk about his approach to leadership during a crisis. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series.
You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and IATA. He currently sits on the boards of Qantas, Bombardier, BOC Aviation, and Trans-Moldavian Airways. Some people said, we're not going to go to work anymore. We're just going to be online. We're going to work from home. And you don't need time in the office. Strikes me as that's overstating it. But in your long experience, do you need to be with other people in the office? Or can we just do this online for the rest of our lives?
In general, you need to be in the office. When you're running a team, you need to see your members of the team. It's amazing how well teams have performed while they haven't been able to see each other, while they have only been been Zooming with each other and all that. But it's less than ideal. Do you need to be in the office as much? Could people work from home, you know, a day a week? Yeah, they probably could. But if you like, some of the stigma of home working will probably be much reduced after the crisis abates a bit. And so we will see more working from home than we have in the past. It'll be seen as a much more acceptable way to go about things. But the days of the office are not over. I think there's a lot of reasons, social and organisational, why offices are a good idea.
What's the role of the board of directors? So the CEO is the point person leading the charge during the crisis. What's the role of the board during a crisis like this in your experience?
Well, the role, I think, is as it always is, it's to advise, to guide, and to challenge management in a positive way, and ultimately, of course, to take responsibility for the big decisions, and that's what's been going on the various boards that I'm privileged to be part of.
Are they meeting much more frequently during this crisis?
Yes, of course. Meetings have been virtual meetings, phone calls, Zoom calls, and so on. But I think every board that I've been on has established a much more frequent cadence of meetings than we have as a routine.
Who's a leader that you admire during this pandemic? Has anyone who stood out for you as someone you go, they seem to got it righter than most leaders?
I think Alan Joyce, who's the chief executive of Qantas, has done very well. He was the first CEO in Australia, first of all, to waive his salary while the crisis went on. He's done a terrific job of engaging with employees, with frequent virtual town halls and webinars and so on. He's done a great job of lobbying the government in Australia to take sensible measures to help the industry. He's managed his own team very well. They've done a good job there of raising cash and managing their cash resources. He's taken some tough decisions, and there'll be more to come, I'm sure. And also, you know, speaking as a member of the board, you know, I feel I've been kept very well informed, and the market's also been kept very well informed. So I think Alan has really ticked all the boxes that you look for in a crisis leadership like this.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Tony Tyler, former CEO of Cathay Pacific Airways and IATA. How has it affected being locked down in Hong Kong? Are you allowed out to go walk around and things like that, or have you been pretty much in your flat most of the time?
No, there's been no lockdown in Hong Kong, so we've been able to come and go without any restriction. There have been restrictions on the number of people you can associate with when you're not at home. But it's been, to be honest, Hong Kong has had a much more normal lifestyle, I think, than pretty well anywhere else. Of course, nobody's traveling, which has meant actually it's been socially quite an active time because everybody's here. However, you know, it's also people have stayed at home more. I mean, people haven't been going to the office. People have been a number of people have been keeping a little bit to themselves, which makes sense. But I've always, you know, I'm always very happy to sit quietly down in the corner and read something. I mean, I'm always very happy to do that.
Are you Zoomed to death?
I've been doing plenty of Zooming and odd hours of the day and night, both actually socially, talking to family and friends as well as business. But I think it's great. Look, I mean, it's not the same as being with somebody, but it's a lot better than a phone call. So I've enjoyed it.
How do you stay in good shape physically and mentally?
Well, physically, I've always been active physically. I've never sort of got unfit. For many years now, I've worked out on a rowing machine, which is a pretty boring thing to do, but it's certainly a very effective way of burning calories, keeping cardiovascular health, and kind of, you know, using all your muscle groups. So I do that a lot. We also do quite a bit of hiking here in Hong Kong. It's a great place for hiking. And so a good long hike once a week and a couple of sessions on the rowing machine a week. And that keeps me pretty fit. Mentally, you know, I, I, you know, I, I don't know. I think I have a fairly positive attitude to life. I don't worry about things I can't do anything about. I'm in a reasonably good place there, I think.
When you get back to flying, what's your first place you'd love to visit?
Well, we have a house in France, and where we like to go and spend the summer when it gets pretty hot and sticky here in Hong Kong. That's the first place we're going to go when we can. We're going to relocate to our house in France and relax there. And if we have to spend a couple of weeks there in isolation, that's really no great hardship. We're very happy to do that.
Final question. What book are you reading right now?
Well, I have just finished reading The Plague by Albert Camus, which I thought, given what's going on in the world now, would be something I ought to read. And I know a lot of other people have read it. And so I've just put that down. And now I'm going to decide. I read it in English. And I'm going to decide whether I'm going to try and read it in French or whether I'm going to read something else. And the next book I'm going to read, if it's that, will be The Leopard, which I read many years ago, but I want to read again.
This has been the CO Series. This show is produced by Marie Lebrasse. I'd also like to thank our technical producer, Brian Kaulisser. Thank you for tuning in to the CO Series. À la prochaine.
For more info and full interviews, go to cjad.com now.